Testing 1, 2, 3, podium mic, Monday, November 3rd. Standing mic. Judge DeMoss. Judge Wiener. Judge Garza.
Mr. Eberle.
Good morning. As the district court noted in this case, United States versus Dixon controls the issue, that issue being whether the evidence was sufficient, viewed in the defendant's favor, to allow the jury to conclude that there was a high probability that Mr. Long committed his acts as a result of a severe mental disease that rendered him unable to appreciate the nature and quality or the wrongfulness of his acts. A review of the Dixon case, we contend, leads to the conclusion that if Mr. Dixon was entitled to a jury instruction, and this court held that he was, so too would is Mr. Long entitled to an instruction. Now, Mr. Dixon robbed several people of their wallets before kidnapping his victim, disguising her in his car, fleeing from the police, bringing her to his home, blindfolded so she could not see where he lived, raped her, handcuffed her, blindfolded her again, took her to the store, ordered her to pretend that she was his girlfriend, brought her back to his home, raped her again, boasted about getting away with this crime, said if and even if the police came, he would use her as a hostage. And then he finally he dropped her off at a payphone, declining to take her to a convenience store on the logic that it would be too suspicious to drop her off at the store. Now, the evidence that Mr. Dixon was insane was a medical record, a long history of diagnosis of schizophrenia, which included evidence that he suffered from auditory hallucinations. He also had a recent diagnosis of bipolar disorder.
Mr. Eberle, I think that to me is the big question. Is an access to disorder, a bipolar disorder, an acute schizophrenia, the same as a access to disorder, the schizotypal personality disorder? I mean, are we talking about apples and apples? Or are we talking about something else?
Well,
and you know, that to me is the crux of whether Dixon applies or not.
Dixon applies because the reason why the Axis I psychosis rendered Mr. Dixon insane, if he was insane, was the psychosis causes him to lose contact with reality, basically causes him to be delusional. Although Mr. Long has an Axis II disorder, he has episodic psychosis, which means that while he might not be psychotic all the time, he does suffer from periods of losing contact with reality.
But isn't that the point? The point is that in Axis I, you are in a constant state of bipolar, you don't know right from wrong. Here, it's in and out. And the question is whether or not he was delusional at the time that he committed these crimes. I'm not convinced that Dixon is that strong for you. You need to kind of tell us a little bit more about why Dixon,
Well, you know, in Dixon, the court, this court, pretty much relied on the diagnosis without getting too much into the facts of the crime. I mean, he committed a rape and a robbery; those are, you know, committed every day. There was some evidence that his psychosis may have affected him during the commission of the crime, and that was that he thought maybe that his victim didn't mind being kidnapped. that maybe she liked him. But, you know, this is a victim who very wisely did not try to resist.
Well, Judge Garza brought up this axis one and axis two. I don't have the impression that there's a per se rule that it's got to be an axis one. Where does this come from?
Well, it doesn't come from the cases.
It comes from the text. It's the disorder, the mental health disorder book that rates axis one,
right,
and axis two disorders.
Right, and this was an issue brought up.
I know what they are and the differences. I'm talking about a legal rule the implication is if it's axis two, you don't know. If it's axis one, you do. But isn't that something that if it's an axis two that the jury's got to decide?
That would be our position. The issue of axis one and axis two doesn't you know come up in the cases. It was an argument made below. It's an argument the government makes on appeal. But because there's evidence in the record that Mr. Long suffers from what is functionally an axis one disorder at times, and I was building the distinction between the commission of Mr. Dixon's crime, which you know you have to just you have to take it on faith that his disorder rendered him unable to appreciate the.
Mr. Blake, I did not appreciate from any of the briefs that he ever suffered from an axis one disorder. Now, the axis two disorder had periods of delusion.
Correct.
As I understand it.
Correct. And I think
it seems to me that's the point is, and maybe I was getting around it the wrong way, but it seems to me we have two different disorders. And the question is, does the second, the axis two, fit under the definition of section 17?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. The reason why Dixon and Owens, which is the 11th Circuit case upon which Dixon relies, the reason why the court held that there was sufficient evidence for the jury to decide that this person may have been insane by high probability was that he loses contact with reality, which is a feature of psychosis. It is not a permanent feature of schizotypal personality, but it is something that happens to Mr. Long, and in fact has happened, as you know, in Dixon there was, and in Owen there was dispute as to whether there was any psychosis at all. Here, there's no question that this man suffers from something that involves episodic psychosis.
How do you listen? Section 17 it says at the time of commission of the acts, and then it goes on that he suffered from some type of mental disease or defect, was unable to appreciate the nature and quality or the wrongfulness of his acts. And then you go to a whole list of evidentiary points where, he attempted to do certain things, try to avoid him being identified, try to avoid detection, fingerprints, DNA, the whole nine yards, all this litany of person that's very conscious of what he seems to be doing. Now, it could be that this is a jury question and not a legal determination by the by the court.
Well, if the court can accept that episodic psychosis is functionally equivalent to being psychotic at the time, then the fact that he engaged in certain behaviors is not going to be fatal to his argument.
Or at other times, that none of that happened at the time he was committing the crime. Is that correct?
I'm sorry.
All this stuff about trying to evade detection and so forth.
Mr. Long.
I mean, 17 says, as Judge Garza emphasized, at the time of the commission. The other things he did were not at the time of the commission necessarily, were they?
Well,
they were.
I mean, it's a continuing commission, I realize.
Yeah, well, there was reference to him going to the post office and buying self-adhesive stamps and going to Kinko's and doing his own copying.
And then mailing these things at different post offices, so he wouldn't go in at rush hour instead of, you know, at 5, or, you know, when it was very crowded.
Yes, but I have 3 points on this. Number one, the only evidence we have that he had a purpose for buying itself adhesive stamps, or the fact that he even wore gloves or whatever, comes from his own testimony. How much can, if the man's insane, and we're asking him if he's insane, there's but so much reliance you can put on his answer. He goes into a post office and buys self-adhesive stamps to avoid getting his DNA on it. Well, I don't know that you can go into a post office and buy any other kind of stamp. You go to Kinko's. You use the self-service to avoid somebody reading what you're writing. Well, when I go to Kinko's, I, too, use the self-service. My favorite in this case is he's got sometime between April when he mails these letters and sometime between June when he gets caught, he burns his house down. At trial, he says, the reason why I burned my house down was to get rid of the evidence. The evidence was entirely located on a hard drive in his computer. I'm not sure that it's a rational thing to do to burn down your house in order to destroy a hard drive, especially when you're going to copy the hard drive on a disk so you can save it before you burn the house down. Also, this, you know, we would contend that this man had an episodic psychotic event in April when he mailed these letters. He has another one in June when he's sending out these very bizarre emails. All you have to do is read these things to find plenty of evidence that this man is possibly a raving lunatic who's clearly not living in our world. And is he trying to get away with this? No, he's using his own email address. He's referencing his wife's aneurysm. He talks about the arson. Clearly, he's not trying to cover his tracks very well. And the final point is that with Dixon did the same thing in terms of the government made the same argument that because Dixon used coercive force to make people comply with him and because he took evasive action to avoid capture, the government argued that this showed that he knew what he was doing and he knew right from wrong. Well, this court was not deterred in concluding that was not sufficient to override the requirement in that case that the instruction on insanity be given.
Mr. Everly, the burden here is on the defendant to prove insanity by clear and convincing evidence. That's the end part. But the preliminary question is whether you give an instruction of insanity to the jury, and that says when the evidence would allow a reasonable jury to find that insanity has been shown with convincing clarity. Can you please distinguish between convincing clarity and clear and convincing evidence?
I don't think there's
clear and convincing, yes.
Well,
is this the same standard? Is there a different standard
between the
between those two thresholds?
Well, Dixon, I'm not sure which, I'm kind of lost at which the two are. There's the clear and convincing standard that's set out in 17.
Yeah. Now, that's the burden of proof.
Right.
That is the ultimate burden of proof. But it seems to me that this, a jury instruction on insanity is required on a showing of convincing clarity. This seems to me to be a lesser burden. Can you help us with that?
Dixon says that the evidence must be sufficient for the jury to conclude with a high probability that that the defendant was insane at the time of the offense, etc. The Owens Court said that the standard was somewhere between preponderance and the reasonable doubt standard. I don't believe that the...
Well, that's clear and convincing.
Right.
But as Judge Garza indicated, convincing clarity is not a widely used, well-known standard of proof.
And part of the problem is there, you know, you have Dixon and you have F, and you really don't have anything else in this circuit. So you have to divine that from the from this case. And we, you know, the high
if the judge had allowed this to go forward, then the jury would have had to been required to determine and instructed by the judge to determine, you know, is this clear and convincing evidence?
Yes, sir.
The question is, why didn't the jury get an opportunity to do that?
In this case, well, yeah. the judge was driven by he was troubled by the acts that we discussed before that indicated to the judge that he knew what he was doing because he tried to cover his tracks. And as I pointed out, that wasn't sufficient in Dixon. It certainly shouldn't be sufficient here because of the ambiguity in those actions. In addition, one of the central points in this case is that the man's crime itself just seems to come from this delusional aspect of his. All you have to do is read the writings that form the greatest part of this crime. The letters he sent out, the emails he sent to CNN and Al Jazeera and all that, they are so filled with bizarre things. And the baby powder and the child, you can't even summarize it because it makes no sense. And this is what distinguishes Dixon and Owens. And Owens, the guy possessed a gun. I mean, that was the sum total of the crime. In Dixon, you've got a rape and a robbery, crimes that have motives that, you know, we clearly understand are criminal motives that don't require insanity. Here, you almost can't commit this crime unless you have severe mental disease. And so our point is, if Mr. Dixon was entitled to an insanity defense, so too should Mr. Long.
Thank you, Mr. Everly. We'll hear from you on rebuttal. Ms. Kassir.
Good morning, Your Honor. While it is helpful to compare the case of Dixon or Owens to this case really must stand on its own because the defendant in this case is so very different from the defendant in the other cases, and the evidence is quite different. This is certainly an abnormal and a strange individual. He had exhibited eccentric and bizarre view of the world and his place in it. He had two causes. One was to protect the children, to give everyone that notice, and to test the system. The real question is whether his decision to test the system and explain his message about protecting the children was done in a way that exhibited his experience of a psychotic episode at the time that he was doing this. There is no evidence in the record that indicates that defendant was actually experiencing a psychotic episode at the time that he did this. And there are some things in the record that must be considered. The judge did not only consider the concealment. That was certainly there, and there was a great deal of evidence of that, far more than in Dixon. Defendant did have the psychiatric testimony of Friedberg, in which Friedberg accepted Dr. Womack's report, and Dr. Womack was the government's expert. The judge had Dr. Womack's report also. And significantly, while it was a bizarre crime to commit, defendant's offense is a strange combination of the Unabomber and the anthrax scare that had gone on months earlier. Defendant combined those two things. Now, looking at defendant's background, he had a degree in criminal justice. He was very much involved in the medical profession because he was a nurse. He had a great deal of experience with the legal profession and the medical profession. He used all of these buzzwords in his testimony, and you will find in his testimony a constant use of the words paranoid and paranoia, hallucination, hearing voices, delusions, flashbacks, voices, altered sense of reality, altered state of mind, depression, anxiety. Throughout his testimony, you will see these words occurring. But he never says that I was experiencing some really altered state of mind that prevented him from understanding what he was doing.
Ms. Cassier, then how do you explain Dr. Friedberg's testimony that Long's bizarre thinking, maladaptive pattern of behavior, episodic psychosis, and loss of contact with reality? How do you consider that along with everything else that you've said? I mean, it seems to me that there's evidence on the other side also.
His testimony does not pinpoint that particular a psychotic episode at the time that defendant committed these crimes.
How could it?
Pardon?
How could it? He wasn't there. There are no witnesses. What?
That is correct, but he did interview the defendant, and the defendant never told the psychiatrist about these voices. And if you read Dr. Womack's report, he did tell Dr. Womack about voices, but defendant, his explanation of his voices was that he talked to himself a lot, and he talked to himself in a female voice sometimes and sometimes in a male voice. At trial, suddenly these voices became outside of himself. He admitted to Womack that these voices were part of himself, just talking to himself like I suppose anyone would if they're anticipating something happening or a discussion with someone. They may do that just preparing for an argument today. I talk to myself. So it's that kind of thing. And he acknowledged that this occurred with him. But at trial, suddenly it took on the air of being voices outside of himself talking to him. And he never said that the voices told him what to do or how to go about it. They only told him he had to test the system and he had to do something shocking. He chose the method of combining, as I said, the Unabomber and the anthrax scares that were on everyone's mind at the time. This was in 2002, shortly after 9/11. He chose that method of putting his message forward and of getting back to people at the legal and the medical profession for what he perceived to be slights to himself. And the judge had these things available to him. He had Dr. Womack's report, which Dr. Friedberg accepted as accurate.
Ms. Garcia, has the defendant shown that a reasonable jury defined insanity by convincing clarity solely on everybody's description of his bizarre behavior, plus his testimony, plus the testimony of Dr. Friedberg? And if not, why isn't that sufficient at least to instruct the jury?
Because he did not make a connection between the possibility that he had this psychosis at some point during his life or at any point during his life. He did not connect that up in a meaningful way to his actual conduct in April over a period of approximately a week, to his conduct in burning his house down, arson, or to his conduct later in June when he sent out the threatening emails over a period of time.
Wouldn't we expect someone who is insane not to be able to connect them? I mean, we're punishing him for the very thing he's saying is his problem.
He also appears to be rather a manipulative individual, because he tells his psychiatrist one thing and then he comes to trial and he has formulated us.
Shouldn't the jury determine whether he's a manipulator, crazy like a fox, or really crazy?
Because there was no meaningful connection between what he said and his actual conduct that he undertook.
So your point is that when we read the record, we're not going to find any connection between his psychological condition and any testimony that connects that with his acts that he was charged with?
You will not find any serious connection, no. And you will also find in his testimony, because at page 437, and I definitely should have read Friedberg's and defendant's testimony in great detail, and then compare it to Dr. Womack's report and the long history of this defendant. But defendant said that his first step was to not get caught. That's part of the delusion, I guess, not to get caught. To prove to them that people can commit crimes and not get caught. That kind of stuff. He says himself that he committed a crime, that that's what he wanted to prove, that he could commit a crime and not get caught. He asked the police officers when they came, and this is in the record, what took them so long. He gave them hints as to what he was doing.
You said something about no serious connection. What do you mean? Obviously, that implies that there is a connection. So tell me what the connection is and why you characterize that as non-serious.
Dr. Friedberg testified that this type of personality disorder, which is an Axis II disorder, can have episodic psychosis. He said that defendant's letters exhibit, perhaps, he didn't say definitively, but exhibit
this. They never
this.
Do they?
Well, that's probably true, Your Honor. But he did say that that these were indicators of defendant being in an episodic psychosis at the time he did the letters. But listen to what defendant said when he was asked about that. Were you aware of the voices when you were creating this letter? And he said, I didn't have any particular voices right then and there. But it's like these things would just come to me for no reason. Defendant undoes, and maybe he's certainly not aware of what he's doing because he claimed the insanity defense. But defendant undid whatever Dr. Friedberg said by his own testimony.
Let me change the focus. If this had gone to the jury with an insanity instruction and the jury had ruled not guilty by reason of insanity, what would the court have been able to do with or to him?
I believe he would have been confined, Your Honor. I really don't know what the end what would have happened.
He could have been sent back to Fort Worth, couldn't he?
He could have been. This statute was enacted and amended right after the Hinckley trial with a different standard of...
Counsel, let me exhibit my ignorance of insanity and criminal law. Would the government have had any appeal as to the jury finding that Judge Wiener hypothetized?
Your Honor, I honestly do not know. I would not think so, but I would not think so.
So what Judge Walter ruled would pretty much be the final question as to the validity of whatever verdict the jury gave. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I would believe it would be. The jury verdict would have to stand.
Well, as it was without an insanity instruction,
yeah.
He had not claimed that he didn't do it. So he was
no.
Not...
He never did claim that he
yeah.
didn't do it. In
so
fact, he went into great explanation
yeah.
of what he did,
so,
how he did it, when he did it.
So this was his only shot, was insanity, and if it had gone to the jury and they had not found him insane, he would have been guilty. If they had, along with Judge DeMoss's questioning, other than sufficiency of the evidence, which would have been a pretty long shot, that would have been it, too.
Yes.
Okay.
I just wanted to comment that or to reiterate, the defendant's testimony is filled with many of the buzzwords of the legal and medical profession, which are calculated to manipulate, and that Judge Dr. Womack made those comments in his analysis and his evaluation of defendant when he found him both competent and that defendant understood what he was doing at the time that he did it. Someone who acts as deliberately as defendant did, it seems rather difficult to believe that that person is suffering from a psychotic episode in which he does not understand the quality of what he is doing, at least to some degree, and that it is wrong. He committed crimes which were copycat crimes, and defendant was admittedly a CNN junkie. He watched the news, and he knew what was going on. His threats that were made during the in June during the television programs indicate that he's very much aware.
Isn't that the point? I mean, the point is whether he knew right from
wrong.
That
is the point.
You know, a lot of these people are extremely intelligent individuals. They know a lot. The question is, do they perceive their right, their actions as in a right or wrong fashion?
The fact that he copied something that he knew was wrong, with his background, and with, as I said, being a CNN junkie, and I think that term was used at some point, he had to have known that what he was doing was wrong, and he went into great detail and elaborate explanation of what he did and why he did it. He had a noble cause, but he pursued it in a way that was illegal, and that he had to have known that it was illegal. And no one has been able to show that he did not.
I presume both doctors opine that he either was or was not legally insane. I mean, there's a conflict in the evidence. Is that correct? Both doctors?
Both doctors expressed the concern. Womack said that he believed that defendant knew. Friedberg said at trial that he did not believe, and I can't remember the exact quote, but he did not believe that defendant fully appreciated the impact of his conduct on the people that he sent these letters to. What does that mean? It certainly means he didn't fully appreciate, but he maybe appreciated it to some degree, and he knew he was impacting people. His letter says that itself.
Thank you, Ms. Kessinger. Mr. Everly, you have 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Can you tell us what would have happened vis-a-vis Long's future if the jury had considered the issue and then said he is not guilty by reason of insanity?
Well,
what would the by reason of insanity meant vis-a-vis Mr. Long's future?
Well, in terms of whether there could be an appeal by the government.
Well, that does he walk out? Does he walk the streets, or does he go back to some institution?
I think that Ms. Cassier and I, being strictly appellate attorneys who don't know what happens to clients in those situations, I'm going to confess as much ignorance about that as did she. I don't know for sure. I'm sure that these people can be and are committed. I don't know. The not guilty by reason of insanity doesn't let them go out the door.
Isn't that the definition of criminally insane? And don't we have ways to take care of the criminally insane?
Yes, I know that we do. I just don't know what those procedures are. And I do believe that Ms. Cassier is correct in saying that such a verdict would be the legal equivalent of an acquittal, such that the government could not appeal this determination. But I wouldn't stand on that.
And the jury gets no instruction one way or the other on that?
On the consequences of its determination?
Yes.
I'm not, does it get one when it's instructed on the not guilty verdict? I'm not sure. Again, the ignorance derived from not being a trial lawyer. The other point I was going to make is the government relies pretty much exclusively in its rebuttal on Mr. Long's testimony. I don't think that you can place everything on that. If the man's insane, we can't really trust what he says, and that is the ultimate question. And I would point out that Mr. Long was diagnosed as having paranoid psychosis when he was 13. He was hospitalized, institutionalized for 6 months, and his mother testified that she walked in on once. He had a gun in his mouth. He said he was trying to kill deal with the voices in his head. She once called him on the phone and told her to look up at the sky at the jet contrails. He said that this was the government trying to communicate. I'm no expert on this psychiatric issues either, but that seems to be a classic exhibition of someone with paranoid schizophrenia.
Thank you, Mr. Haverly. We note that you are government court appointed, and the court appreciates your service in that respect. Thank you very much. Thank you.